next session here. One of the things that I will do is walk through, as Madam Chair mentioned, some of the forecast highlights and some of the issues we've talked about with the rating agencies and sort of where we would like to go forward. But I think it's important to remember that we've worked a lot this last several years, and certainly this last year. And I want to commend the chair and the vice chair and all the members and the staff at the LCPR for working hard on these issues. They're difficult issues, they're tough issues. The plans have been really very supportive and also very engaged, as all the stakeholders have. And I think it's a realization how important this task really is and how important we all come to this table wanting to try to get something accomplished this year. I know there's some frustration over not having been able to achieve that thus far, but one of the things that I can say on behalf of the governor is that he is very concerned and interested in pension reform. As you may have heard in the February forecast, he made the comment that he was going to wait until after, I'm sorry, the November forecast. He made the comment that after the February forecast, he will come forward with any budget proposals or supplemental budget requests. Clearly, this fits in that category. Pension reform is certainly high on our list of issues to tackle, but clearly we need to see where we are at the end of February with the February forecast, what kind of resources we have available. With that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the February forecast. I just have a few slides about that, and I'm going to keep it at a pretty high level and leave it up to you if you want to get into any questions. One of the things I want to caution is I don't want to forecast the next forecast. I mean, clearly, one of the things I want to do is talk about where we are in November and some things that may come up for February. So in the first slide, if you look on page 2, it mentions that the starting point always for a forecast is the previous forecast. So in November, we were looking back to February of 2017. And since February of 2017, we saw the economic growth weaken some, and therefore we saw some of the projections come down in terms of what we thought the growth was going to be in 2018 and 2019. And because of that, and a few other things that I'll mention in just a moment, we ended up with a $188 million deficit for 18 and 19. And then if you add in the amount for the funding for the legislative appropriation, it would be a little over $300 million. And then a $586 million negative balance for 20 and 21. So that's where we are in terms of going into this the next session until the February forecast comes out the last week of February. You know, we've been able to have 8 straight forecasts in a row, or 4 years of budget balances. And so if you look at slide 3, you can see the projection of the $188 million. And really what's happened, as you can tell from the change column, is we've seen a reduction in the likely revenues based on economic modeling going forward, based on reduced economic growth. Just a couple of 0.2 percentage points, we reduced revenues by $559 million. We've also seen a slight increase in spending of $398 million, but a large portion of the $398 million is the 25% premium relief package that we passed in 2017 that carries over from one biennium to the next biennium. So even though it looks like there's more spending here, there's also more funds that come with that spending. So it overstates some the spending that we anticipate increases for the next biennium. So one of the things that when we looked at the this forecast, we wanted to make sure that we really put in time where we are right now. Clearly, we've only completed the first 6 months, and this data is even less than 6 months for this biennium, and we have another almost a year and a half to go. We forecast current law. So one of the things that we will be doing in February is forecasting the current law for Minnesota. And that means we will not be taking into account any potential federal conformity that may or may not happen in this next session. We have to start with where we are and project with what's going to happen in the next year. That's one of the difficulties that we're going to have to grapple with. I think this session will see some difficult challenges to decide what exactly we do in the face of the federal tax bill. It made a lot of significant changes. And the number one thing, you know, back in 1987, we made the decision to conform to federal taxable income after the 1986 Tax Reform Act. at the time, it seemed like a good idea, and I guess now we're sort of wondering whether that was, but clearly that's what we did. And so now we're in a situation where in order to stay conformed to the federal taxable income or the federal tax code, we're going to need to make some technical changes. And then we're going to need to decide, well, given those changes, what do we want to do as policymakers to affect positively or negatively how that affects Minnesota taxpayers? And that's going to be we're still working on that, still trying to sort out all the nuances to that package. It's very complicated. And I think that's one of the challenges we're going to face in terms of trying to figure out, do we maintain a revenue neutral situation? Do we increase, decrease revenues to the state of Minnesota based on the federal tax bill? So there are a lot of issues that we'll layer on top of whatever the forecast is. So just to sort of get you all excited about this next session and some issues to talk about, that certainly is one of them. But if you look at slide four, I wanted to include slide four just to recall why there's so much changing. I mean, one of the things that happened in the last session was we decreased revenues by $657 million, and we had spending of $816 million. So you take those two in combination. We changed our base so that in February, when we were forecasting the economic growth, we did it with a different base. We did it with a different revenue base, and we did it with a different spending base. So all of those have effects on what happens going forward. So there are consequences, obviously, to spending and tax breaks. And you take collectively that situation, and we were down to $163 million as a balance after the end of session in June 2017. And then in November, we did the forecast on top of that new balances. So I just think it's important for us to remember that with any changes, any budget changes, we're going to affect the base that we have going forward. And please ask questions as we go along. One of the things I wanted to hit on page five was just some of the risk. I mean, we've all talked about these risks that we have, and certainly we continue to have some uncertainty in federal tax policy in terms of what it means for Minnesota, but also federal budget policy is still uncertain. We do believe that inflation continues to grow, and we believe it's going to continue to grow in the future as we go forward. Capital gains is an area where it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. This is one of the areas where we are trying to understand taxpayer behavior. There was some concern in the federal government and a number of different states this last year that some folks were delaying recognition of capital gains pending this tax bill at the federal level to see what happened and whether there was going to be a reduction in capital gains. So with that decided, we may see some economic behavior here that's different than what we've seen the last year or so, which could cause either an uptick or a reduction in capital gains. So that is something that we'll try to watch pretty closely. The other thing is the fact that we're in the end, or not the end, but we're getting into a long, slow growth expansion. And so I think it's next year we'll reach a point where we'll have one of the longest growth expansions, longest terms that we've had in recent times. So that's another thing to be watching is how long can and how long will this economic expansion continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, in light of your comments with regard to slide number two, again, recognizing that you're not wanting to forecast the forecast for February, but it was just announced for the November-December period that revenues were increased by $219 million over expectation. Those were all revenues. We didn't see the expenses. But in light of that, I'm just wondering if that changes your comments or if you'd like to color them a little differently, and I have a follow-up.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, excellent question. What day was that? Wednesday, the 10th of this month, we released the revenue memo. And just one caution about that, and that is that of the $143 million in increased revenues for income tax, $101 million was related to taxpayers paying their taxes in 2017 rather than waiting until this month to pay some of their taxes. So part of that is simply taking money from January and putting it into December and therefore being caught by that revenue report. So that makes you have a little bit of caution to the number. But nonetheless, all the other numbers, I mean, the sales tax was almost spot on, but the other numbers, the income tax and the other categories were all up. So that is a positive sign. I mean, clearly, you don't want to go into a new forecast coming up in February where everything's coming in less than what you forecasted just a few months ago. So I think it shows us that we're on the right track in terms of what we're projecting for income growth. And in that report, our national consultants, IHS, increased the GDP growth for 2018 and for 2019 by about 0.2%, I think, for both. So that will have an effect on our forecasting. So both of the revenues coming in ahead of projections and an increase in the GDP growth by our national consultants will cause Dr. Klumpakidis and her group to look a little bit differently at what kind of projections they're going to make. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I don't, it's still, you know, a month, what, 5-6 weeks away from the next forecast, but it certainly is good news.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, we hear a lot about the effect nationally of pension plans and their underfunding and how that can affect bond rating or the quality or that is assessed to a state's bond quality and rating. And we heard that Minneapolis just recently was downgraded because of a concern for the amount of debt that they're taking on. But with regard to the pensions that we have yet to solve the riddle on for the last 2 years, what inference or communication are you receiving from the bond houses in terms of their concerns and or their assessment of the state's financial wherewithal going forward in consideration of what we do with the pension issue?
Commissioner France.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, if you go to slide 7, I wanted to talk about that in particular because we met with the rating agencies in September right in advance of our little over $800 million bond sale that we did in late September or October? In September. And we spent quite a bit of time with the rating agencies. And luckily for Minnesota, I was more my charming self back then, I think, than I was today. But the key was we spent a lot of time talking to them about what this commission did the last several years and what we – and, you know, obviously we had a good return year. We had a 15.1% return year for the plans, which helped alleviate some of the unfunded liability burden. But they were very interested in listening to the work that the commission had done in a bipartisan way to come up with some – ways to have sustainability packages. They were very impressed with the fact that we were tackling the discount rate, for example. They were very impressed that we had a model of shared sacrifice where the employer, the employee, and the retirees all share in any sustainability package. They will be watching us closely. So I can't tell you what they're going to do in the summer if, in fact, we don't do pension reform. But I will tell you that they'll be watching us, and they expect a AAA state is a state, in their view, that does tackle these kinds of issues. And a AAA state doesn't leave these kind of issues on the table, so to speak, over time. So our time is, you know, is critical in terms of making sure the credit agencies see us as responsible in dealing with these issues. So that's one of the reasons, and I came back and told the governor and other folks that it's important from that point of view that we seriously take pension reform as an important issue to deal with this year, even though we do have to wait to see what resources we have in the February forecast. And I've had a chance to visit with the chair and the vice chair and members of the staff. We really want to begin working now before the session starts even to figure out what kind of agreement or package we can come up with in the event that we do have resources to make this resolution. But it's important to tackle, and they'll be watching us as much as I can say, I think.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Franz, Commissioner Franz.
I like chair. That's okay.
No, you're returning to your cheery self. So let's just say, for the example of Fitch's, which right now offers us a AAA bond rating, let's just paint a very dark picture and say that we don't succeed in providing pension reform during this session. Can you quantify for the commission dollars and cents if they were to say, based upon the inaction of the legislature, and we're downgrading you to a AA+, what that would cost in terms of additional borrowing costs for the same bonding that we would need, say, on $800 million. Can you quantify that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. It's really difficult to do because there's so many variables involved. Part of the issue is really when you go to the market, obviously. One of the things that we have to do as we contemplate, as we contemplate when to go to market is the market conditions can sort of overwhelm the benefit you get by a rating in some cases. Clearly, this last October, we saved about $40 million in refinancing some of our older bonds that we had the flexibility to do that with. So that was a situation where the good credit agency rating gave us. A big chunk of that $40 million was due because of the good rating that we had. But it's really hard, to be fair, to put a price tag on that because of the other market factors that can sometimes overwhelm the rating. But it's not insignificant. It's in the tens of millions of dollars every time we sell $500, $800 million. But I don't have a good estimate for you.
Further questions?
If we go back, just step back to page 5. Well, I guess we were through with page 5. And look at, there is no page 6. We're just testing to see if you're paying attention. If we go to page 8, let's talk a little bit about, you have a 6. I don't have a 6.
Commissioner, we do have a page 8. Economy and wages continue to grow only more slowly.
Right. That is page 6. Am I just not opening that?
That's okay. You're handicapped right now.
I do have it. I'm sorry. I'm just incapable of opening the page. Yeah, I don't know why you have me here in front of you today. This really is sort of where we are. We feel we are coming out of the November forecast, and that is that we are seeing a growing economy. And even though we reduced economic growth from February to November, it's still a growing economy, and wages are increasing, and wages and income is growing. So, and our employment rate continues to be lower than the U.S. rate. There was an article, I think some of you may have seen it, about Nashville and Minneapolis that had a 2.3 unemployment rate for the metropolitan areas, two of the lowest in the country. So we are really doing a tremendous job in terms of putting people to work, but as our state economists and also the demographer have talked about, there are some challenges with that going forward in terms of the labor pool is getting smaller and smaller, and we need to really figure out ways to make sure that we can expand that pool, expand opportunities for people, because employers are going to continue to expand in Minnesota only if we have the people that can do the work for them. But I think one of the things that we came away with in November was a sense that there are both some upside risk, and in which we got with the tax bill, the increased GDP growth was one of the things we saw from upside risk. But there are downside risks as well. We still don't know of the status of the Children's Health Insurance Program, whether that's going to be completely funded or not. We know that it's been partially funded. We're still trying to figure out what exactly that means in terms of dollars. But nonetheless, there's still over $140 million that has not been funded yet for the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is another important piece going forward. So there are both upside and downside risks going forward to the economy. I'm ready to...
Commissioner, Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, just one other question that's been, I don't know how relevant it is, but that's been on my mind. How much is the legislative budget? Because that was not included in the forecast, right?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it was not included. It's $114 million. So if you add that to the $188 million, it's about a $312 million deficit.
And Commissioner, I do have a question. So the most recent estimate from the Department of Revenue on the tax bill indicated a forecast adjustment of a positive $154 million on increased international business income. So hypothetically, if you had that and you had that adjustment early and you had the CHIP money, would we be seeing a positive November adjustment or forecast?
Madam Chair, you're really pushing me on this, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even in, you know, later December, and with some of the growth factors that came in late December, we saw some improvement in some of the growth for the last quarter, although the overall growth for 2017 didn't change that much. So we do see a number of positive factors on the horizon. It's just that one of the big uncertainties that could swallow up a lot of this is the tax bill, unfortunately, that has us concerned about what does that mean, and what does that mean? It's hard to predict what taxpayers are going to do. We'll have like 2 months' worth of data in February to decide what are taxpayers going to do based upon the new federal tax law, and what are they anticipating from Minnesota. So, I do agree. There are a lot of positive factors heading toward February.
And one of the other positive factors, which I'm going to push you on too, Commissioner, is because of the federal tax bill, you've seen some large Minnesota employers giving out bonuses, increasing their wage. You got Wells Fargo increasing their minimum wage by 11%, U.S. Bank giving bonuses to their 60,000 employees. You've got Walmart raising their starting wage. So that there is a positive ramifications because of the federal tax bill, which is hard to quantify, but I think there is momentum.
Madam Chair, well, that's a good point. And one of the things we've been, the last several years actually, is somewhat, what's the right word, not certain why the wages and income haven't grown a little bit more as the pool of workers has shrunk and as more demand and more competition. We really thought that the income and wages would be going up faster, but this is an indication that at least it's happening now.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Senator Lerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, in reference to the federal tax bill, I've heard discussion that certain states that are considered high tax states are, for lack of a better word, penalized, or it triggers other expenses. How does Minnesota fit into that spectrum, and how would it affect our revenue stream?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think one of the things that clearly Minnesota's state and local tax deduction has been affected with the cap now at $10,000 per year is something that will have a direct effect on Minnesota taxpayers. So for those taxpayers who are used to itemize and deduct more than $10,000 for state and local or property taxes, we're going to see a reduction in they're going to see a increase in their federal taxable income. Now, some of that will be offset depending upon what bracket they're in, right? So because some of the federal tax brackets were reduced, and there's one or so, I think, that was unchanged. But so there's going to be this trade-off at the federal level. And then the question really becomes in Minnesota, are we as a state going to change that that mix? Some of the other states that have a higher tax burden than Minnesota, like New York and California, are considering making some changes to their state law to try to provide some flexibility to allow for that state and local deduction to continue in some form, and that they're getting kind of creative about some of that. I'm not suggesting we do that, but what I am suggesting is that it is, people have gotten used to this, and so it's going to cost people, and the charitable deduction is another one of the things that I think charities are concerned about. What effect is this going to have on charitable giving going forward? These are really tough questions, and so I am still studying the bill myself, and I don't have any good more insight than that at this time. Well,
thank you. Continue.
Let's talk a little bit about the deficit, and as Representative Thiessen mentioned, so we do have some things to do this next session, and right now we don't have the resources to do that. So the state law provides that we can solve the deficit by going to the reserve right now. And the governor has decided to wait to do that until after the February forecast, in part because with the late start in the session and a lot of uncertainty, we thought it would be best to see what if it changes there might be before we go to the reserve. Because, as you know, we can take money out of the reserve to solve the deficit, but we can't put it back in there without, you know, legislative action. So, and the leaders, in talking with the legislative leaders, everyone sort of agreed, well, let's wait on that. But I would also urge caution on using the reserve at this time. The reserve is really established to help in serious economic downturn situations. And this, in our view, is not a serious economic downturn. This is a revision of, you know, economic growth. And I, as commissioner, would caution us all to think about other ways to solve the deficit, if we have one in February, other than going to the reserve. And that's sort of, that is certainly a way to do it. But we just wanted to make, we have $1.6 billion in that reserve, and our target's a little over $2 billion. So we actually would like a little bit more to have in there to have available if we have a serious economic downturn. So that's what it's designed to be there for. So I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that.
Commissioner,
that caution.
Before you continue on, can you just explain a little bit what the bond houses say about our reserve and where they would like to see that at?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the bond, the rating agencies are extremely, in fact, Pew Research has written several articles about the Minnesota Reserve policy as a great way to establish a reserve and to maintain the reserve based on income revenue volatility, based on a percentage of non-dedicated general fund revenue. So they like the mechanism that we set up back in 2014. They think it works really well. They think it's a good way to get to the right target. They understand our target and don't, I think they, I don't know if they necessarily agree with, but they appreciate the target that we have. I think that's part of the reason we got to AAA with Fitch in 2016 is we made a lot of progress toward filling up that bucket. I don't know what we had in 2016, but it was, I think, over $1 billion in that time period. So I think that's helping, frankly, offset some of any other concerns that they have. If they've seen us in the last 4 years have traditional surpluses, they've seen us increase the reserve on an annual basis, and so they'll be watching to see how we solve the current deficit, whether we use the reserve or whether we come up with some other budget ways to solve that in the next session. And I think the governor has made it clear that to the leaders that he wants to work with them to solve this whatever deficit we have, if we have one, rather than just automatically going to the reserve. So I think it's an opportunity for the legislature and the governor to solve this problem in a way that, once again, I think the rating agencies would find to be a positive way to solve the deficit.
Thank you.
Well, let's couple other issues I wanted to mention. If you, Madam Chair, if we go to slide 8, clearly we've seen some change in the valuation, the actuarial valuations of the unfunded liability, and in large part because of the return that we had in fiscal year 2017. Which was 15.1%, I believe. So we've seen this story could have been a lot worse if we hadn't had that. And so, in a sense, sometimes it's good to be lucky as opposed to right. And so we're in that situation. We've got a little bit more room to work with. But clearly, I think the plans will be making it clear today that they're, from their view, that there need to be some changes made to maintain long-term sustainability packages. But I think one of the things that we wanted to do was to note that we do have an unfunded liability issue that we think we need to work on and resolve, and we can't always rely on a 15.1% return year. So that's really what I wanted to make sure that we felt that we were on the same page there. If you look at page,
Commissioner,
yes,
on that slide 8 on your June 30th of 2017. That funding ratio, is that at the 7.5 or at 8.0 assumed rate?
Which is?
Discount rate.
Eight. Madam Chair, that's still at the statutory rate. So until we change the statutory rate, the commission changes that, it's still at the 8%.
These figures are high, Mr.
Yes.
Moore, correct?
Correct.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So that's why the situation improved with the rate of return, but we still have this ticking time bomb problem there that we need to resolve.
Thank you.
You know, if you look at page 9, this was where we started. The governor started last year when we engaged in the dialogue with the commission, and clearly that was based upon shared sacrifice, 7.5% return, discount rate return, and we look forward to, like I say, that was our starting point last year, and clearly the commission got a bill put together and got a lot of votes for that, so we're mindful of that, respectful of that, and want to work with the commission going forward to see if we can fashion another policy. The costs are going to be different. I mean, we have 1 year to fund in this biennium now instead of two, so the funding, any change for this biennium will be, by definition, about half as much as it would have been before because of only 1 year. But we'll have to then figure out what kind of, if we come up with an agreement, what kind of phase-in do we have? Is it over 2, 3, 4 years? So I think that's something that we're really working toward in the future, working with this commission going forward. I really only have one other comment I want to make about the LCPR bill, and that's on slide 10. And this is really some thought that we've put into this deferred augmentation issue over the last several months. We come to this table really with two hats on. One hat, obviously, is from the chief financial officer, making sure that we maintain the right status and funded status and helping the plans do that. But we also come as the chief human resource officer, too, recruiting and looking toward to bring people to government service in the next 5 to 10, 20 years. And we already know that is changing over time and that we're seeing some people come in for the long term, but we're seeing people come in for 5 years or 10 years and then leave. And we just felt that after reviewing some of the deferred augmentation changes that we'd like to have more of a conversation about that to make sure that the benefits that someone gets for 5 or 10 years and then they leave and take whatever contributions they have really is seen as a positive to them. We don't want them to feel like they're subsidizing the long-term employees by not getting their fair share of their investment that they've had while they were state employees. So it's something that we would like to have more discussion with the staff and the commission in the next month or so and make sure that we're doing the right thing, both for the plans in terms of funding, but also for recruiting in the long term.
Commissioner, if you wouldn't mind just explaining in your terms deferred augmentation.
Madam Chair, I'm going to dial up my friend here and let Britta Raton.
Madam Chair, I'm Britta Raton in the Budget Division. What we're speaking about is currently when members separate from state service, their benefit is calculated at that time, and then it grows by 2% per year until they reach retirement age. So essentially that benefit maintains buying power, purchasing power, until they reach retirement age. Many folks do leave their benefit with the state when they leave or with their employer and choose to take that pension once they reach retirement age. The other option when someone separates is that they can get paid back just their employee contribution. So they're not taking with them the employer side of the contribution. And when they get paid back that employee contribution, they get a 4% interest rate for the years that they were in state service. The LCPR bill took the deferred compensation benefit and took it to zero. So instead of having a 2% increase on that benefit each year until they reach retirement age, it stayed at zero. So essentially, if an employee came in for the first 10 years of their career, left state service in their early 30s, their benefit would not grow in any sort of inflationary way until they reach a retirement age of 66. Or if they alternatively decided to take their own contributions out, their employee side contributions out, the LCPR bill reduced that interest rate that they would earn from 4% to 3%. And we were just concerned that this would have an impact on how folks viewed a short term of service with the state, particularly at the beginning of their career.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lincheski, if I remember correctly from our conversations centered around this issue, Minnesota is pretty unique in offering this, right? Where maybe there's, I think, maybe one of two states that actually offer this. And so do we know what kind of impact this has made on other states that don't offer this? Have they had problems finding people that will work for the state? Or have we had any kind of feedback on that at all?
Ms. Lincheski.
Representative Anderson, Chair Rosen, with no other state except for South Dakota, and this is a recent benefit reform over in South Dakota for newer hires, it's hard to say whether they have been losing people or having any effect really on their employment retention in the state. There's just no research out there for it. We do know that nobody else has it. For some reason, Minnesota introduced that concept a few years ago, but we don't have any actual experience or anything to look to. We do have one close-to-home experience, which is PARA. PARA General does not have augmentation for newer hires. They could speak to whether they see any impact, but I understand those changes were made at a time when other changes also went into effect. So, again, we can't really look at that particular change and say it caused this kind of behavior.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great point, and that's one of we're not experts in this, and one of the things we wanted to do was take some time to study to see if what's going on out there to see if to make sure that we hit that right. We believe there's a sweet spot in here in terms of what is the right benefit calculation, and we just want to make sure we understand that a little bit better, but we think we need to do some more study.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the Commissioner and the team from MMB for being with us here today. Just a couple of comments and observations on the presentation today, as well as maybe just a few follow-up questions. In your presentation today, Commissioner, you talked about the economy, wage growth being a concern. I think we've addressed that. At least some employers are starting to view that differently, and that's going to benefit Minnesotans on that as well. One of the missions of the tax bill was to reduce individual income tax rates, which means there's more spendable income, which clearly are going to have positives on Minnesota's economy. You also said the company that Minnesota uses to help calculate the forecast has also added additional basis points onto the GDP for the state of Minnesota, all positives, all strong things moving us in the right direction. Albeit we've had some of the tax revenues on income tax shifted into the calendar year of 2017, my rough math from your numbers looked at $114 million in excess of what we had anticipated. So we are definitely in a solid position on this. I also want to thank you yesterday when I extended the offer. In the past, we haven't always had the opportunity early on in the session to engage the governor's office on these matters, and we've been kind of shooting in the dark, if you will, as trying to figuring out where we're going to go. And I appreciate your commitment with the three of you having the commissioner volunteered the three of them to be a part of the negotiating team with the pension commission to help come to what we hope would be an equitable solution. One of the things I have concern about, and if you are looking at your packets, and that's page 7 with the rating agencies, the commissioner was very good about talking about the fact that the rating agencies did not do a direct downgrade of the state's rating. One of the things that folks need to maybe know a little bit about the three different rating agencies, Fitch, which is what the commissioner referenced, is probably the smallest and the, I won't say the least credible, because I'm not questioning that. I'm just saying fewer people, when they look at making investments in paper that's been graded, don't use Fitch. The ones that they do place a lot of weight on are Moody's and S&P. And one of the things that, if you take a look at the narrative as a result of the bond issuance in 2017, in September, it did indicate a paragraph in there citing some concerns about Minnesota's unresolved pension issues and uncertainty on that. And so I would be willing to speculate that if for some reason the legislature, through their work, is unable to come to agreement with the governor, we will see at the end of this administration, at the beginning of the next administration, given the governor's indication of not running for reelection, that that could affect Minnesota's bond rating. And so I do hope that we can work together to get to an equitable solution on this. My final comment, and I guess I maybe don't necessarily have questions, and it's relating to deferred augmentation. And I appreciate the discussion being brought forward that not all of Minnesota's pension plans have deferred augmentation anymore. There are just some that do. And some plans had seen the benefit of, in essence, a person who has made an employment decision to leave the public employment and go somewhere else for whatever other benefits package, bonuses, incentives, professional development, career to do that. they would terminate receiving augmentation benefits. They would still obviously be able to get their pension benefits. What wasn't mentioned is that embedded in that, there are some who get larger augmentation benefits than 2% as well. So I want to be transparent with everyone who's here today. Although we did not talk about all the specifics, it's not that everything is treated equally on this. There are some changes, and some of the plans have seen the benefit of moving from that deferred augmentation. And, of course, employees would know that going into their employment situation and make that as a decision. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to summarize and to share some thoughts this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I don't know if this is to Commissioner. What's the state's interest in encouraging people who leave to stay in the pension plan versus leaving it?
Commissioner.
Sure. There is some interest in having folks keep their retirement dollars in the pension plan because it is a secure retirement vehicle. If someone takes a payout of their own personal contributions, they may not be reinvesting those into a retirement plan. And so the state does have an interest in having people adequately save for retirement and for policy purposes. And so having some incentive to leave your investment within the pension system benefits the state in the long run.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, though, it raises two questions for me. One is, you mentioned that it's a policy initiative to want people to keep their money in the plan. But doesn't that indicate more of a maternalistic attitude about, which I don't disagree with, but doesn't it offer up also maybe a larger concern that we are not addressing what I have called kind of the financial illiteracy that we have in this state, and maybe is in as much as that we worry about the dollars, we should worry even more about educating and helping people appreciate the relevance of planning for the retirement. Could you address that,
Madam
Commissioner?
Chair, excuse me, I had to put a cough drop in. No, I Representative, I think you're right, and I think that's work that we need to do a better job of. I think, you know, the plan, and I appreciate what the plans do in terms of trying to do with their education and outreach for their members, but I think more broadly speaking, that's something that we've discussed a lot in Governor Dayton's administration, is the concern about retirement savings in general or the lack thereof, and the fact that a lot of people don't aren't saving as much as they could or should, or we're not providing the right vehicles or the right ways to do that. So I think we certainly would encourage, and in some cases, I work with the National Association of State Treasurers, and in many cases, it's the state treasurer's office that takes on this financial literacy issue, and in our State Department of Commerce does a lot of that. But we do believe that there's a lot to be done and a lot to be said for providing vehicles for people to save for retirement and providing more education about that. So I don't think we would ever assume that just by fixing whatever we do here, our job's not done. I mean, we need to do more, and I hope maybe that's something we can talk about as the commission is, what more could we do to help the plans and other people who aren't in the plans to understand how to plan for retirement. It's a huge problem.
Representative Albright.
Well, I'm not going to get on much of a soapbox here, but
yeah.
I think addressing the financial literacy of the populace when it comes to retirement is kind of in the 11th hour if it happens just before they retire. And I would assert and strongly urge you as the treasurer, as a CFO for the administration, to possibly use this opportunity as an initiative for bringing financial literacy into the educational system, even at the 9 through 12 area. You know, we send people out in the world to do a job, but we don't teach them how to balance a checkbook or to talk about retirement or about health care, for that matter, two topics that are simply, you know, without, you know, stop in terms of talk around this campus. And so just as an op-ed, maybe we should start that financial literacy much earlier than 2 hours before they sign the retirement pages to take a distribution.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm still a little bit bothered on slide number 8. Looking at an unfunded liability of $13.7 billion, and I realize that statutorily we're saying 8%, and we've been talking about 7.5%, but then also, as I understand it, the accounting rules changed in 2014, that once that rate starts to drop and you get past the point of solvency, that actually you have a blended rate. So as I look at slide 7 and our ratings and slide 8, and if that's the information we're going to rely on or at least even have in our minds, I'm wondering how that would compare to what is actually going to happen relative to especially S&P and Moody's.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, you raise a really good point, and I'll let Paul Moore, the Executive Budget Officer, talk a little bit about that. But part of the issue, and I think it's the way that these numbers are presented and through some of the new financial disclosure rules really are causing some concern about how we manage this. But I'll let Paul kind of talk a little bit about how that.
Mr. Moore.
Sure. Madam Chair.
Welcome.
And Representative, the numbers shown on slide 8 reflect the statutory investment rate of return, which is 8% for all plans other than TRA, which is 8.5%. And the reason we showed it at that statutory rate is because we presented the slide in the context of our rating agency presentations, where we need to reflect in our conversations the rate of return that is established in law. The rating agencies, as well as now all the plans are, and the LCPR is all in agreement that investment return should be lowered to 7.5%. And as the commissioner had mentioned, that went a long way in those rating agency presentations in evaluating our pension liabilities. In reference to GASB and the new reporting standards, as you had mentioned, under GASB, we are required to reflect our liabilities and our investments in a market rate or a market value of assets, so we're not allowed to provide some sort of actuarial smoothing. We do when looking at numbers at the LCPR, and as you had mentioned, we take that assumed rate of return until the point at which assets are projected to be depleted. They are it is then reduced to a high yield bond or high bond yield somewhere around 3%, and then we come to this blended rate, which is much lower than the assumed rate of return. And increasingly, our bond agencies are looking at those GASB valuations in determining our pension liabilities. And so from that point of view, it provides even more credence and importance to fixing our unfunded liabilities.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I guess my point was that if indeed this information was given to the rating agencies when you had your visit and they were willing to accept it, I'm assuming there was an assumption that it's going to change drastically the next time there's a conversation and the rating might change, so that we don't walk away from here thinking that slide 8 is actually a slide that we could even live with or even partially maybe believe. And that was the reason for my concern, is that my thought is that maybe we have a little bit of a meeting that's going to have to be a conversation sometime this summer with the rating agencies and be more consistent with what's going on and actually even be able to prove that we can make 7.5 rather than what we assume at 8. So
exactly. Thank you, Representative. Yeah. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, you know, one of the things that the new GASB rules have caused a lot of and we talked specifically about those different valuations with the rating agencies, and they tend to, you know, the GASB rules are great in the sense what they're trying to do is smooth everything out so you can compare apples to apples from one state to the other state, right, and not have these wide variations in valuations from one state law to another state law. So certainly the intent the intent of those rules is good, and the problem is it has some defaults in there that can cause some pretty big distortions. And the rating agencies know this, and we're really upfront about that. But I think you're right that we're going to have to make sure that when we talk to the rating agencies after this commission approves and gets passed the best possible tax reform we can have this year, and we talk to them this summer, we'll still have to deal with that issue. Even if we have a new sustainability package, there will still be some discrepancies between the GASB rules and these statutory actuarial rules. So that's an issue, not a problem. It's an issue we have to deal with.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, as you're looking at these numbers, earlier you had mentioned that you didn't view the deficit of $188 million as worthy of dipping into the reserves. Is it the administration's position that the unfunded liability also falls into that category?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I wouldn't say it's not. We want to have a conversation with the legislature before we do that dip into the reserves to solve this deficit. And I don't. There's been no discussion about the unfunded liabilities falling within that category. I think we've always considered this to be a separate discussion, apart from any budget deficit that we're facing. So the governor really wants to sit down with the legislative leaders after the February forecast, figure out what we should solve, if we have anything to solve or not, and then separately from that, then decide what we can do about this unfunded liability. So we really look at it as a two different pathway discussion.
Representative Anderson.
And then, Madam Chair, for the administration, where does the unfunded liability fall within your priorities for spending?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative. Well, we're concerned about it. I mean, I think the $188 million deficit is not huge compared to what we've experienced in the past, but it's concerning. I think we feel the same way about the unfunded liability. It's important to address. And so it's high on our list of to address. We just feel that we're 6 weeks away from knowing what kind of resources we have to bring to bear. And if we don't have those resources, then what do we do? That's going to be a harder discussion about how and if we can resolve the unfunded liability with no current resources if there's a deficit still. So we simply don't want to solve a problem that may not exist yet at this point if we're fortunate and have a surplus.
Representative Albright, then we're going to wrap it up.
Yep, thank you. So, Commissioner, just remind for me and maybe for the members the process of putting that economic forecast together and who is responsible for assembling that as you would announce it and propose it to the legislature and to the public. Who's all involved in that process?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, Dr. Klumbakidis, the state's economist, has an economic unit that is in charge of compiling, analyzing the forecast data. The process we go through really is to take a look at what IHS, our national consultants, tell us about the U.S. economy and their projections of economic growth going forward. And then the state economist brings together the Board of Economic Advisors twice, and once in late January and once in February, to take a look at, from their point of view, does this forecast from IHS, do they agree with it? Is it somehow not reflecting what's going on in Minnesota? We talked specifically on the second meeting about the Minnesota risk or the Minnesota uniqueness to any forecast issue. Maybe it's an agricultural issue or whatever. So there are those two meetings that then feed into her analysis of the forecast. And at the same time, Margaret Kelly, the budget director, is putting together the budget perspective in terms of what is current law for the budget. And so we need to feed that into the forecast. So it's a combination of finding out what do we have in the bank, so to speak? What are our current resources, and what do you anticipate we're going to need to spend in the next year and a half, and then 2 years after that, and then how much money do we anticipate coming from the economic growth in the next year and a half, or then 2 years after that? So that's a process that we'll use to get to that final forecast in late February.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Mr. Moore and Commissioner for coming. That was a very good discussion.
Thank you.
We're very interested in, and looking forward to our discussions going forward. Members, we're going to – I'm going to have Ms. Lencheski go through a quick review of the 2017 LCPR bill, what was passed off the floors, both bodies. Also, Senator Pappas was able to go to a meeting with the Pew Foundation, and she was kind enough to bring back a guide, and you all have that. I know just talking with the fund directors yesterday, I had to kind of take a quick moment to understand pensions again. So this might be a really good piece for you to review, and if you'd like to share it with your other members that who are getting interested in pensions. And we'll get one to Senator France, too. So with that, we do have some in your – is this in your packet?
It's in the folders.
It's in the folder of our review. It's the brightly colored piece. And Ms. Lencheski, if you could review that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your pack, in your folders, is a two-page, very colorful summary. This is a summary of and before I talk about that, I'll also mention that there are three other items that come right after the colorful two-pager. And these are letters from the actuaries of the three statewide plans. And they are just some additional reading material if you are interested in what the actuaries are telling the plans about the 7.5% rate of return versus their current rate of return. The one is what, from Kavanaugh McDonald, is actually what TRA is referring to as their mini experience study. And it is interesting reading if you're interested in what the actuary is seeing with our teachers' retirement fund. So those are the three items other than this colorful summary. The summary is a summary of really three different bills because as things progressed at the legislature last session, we had plans in the bill at the start but did fall out then as things progressed towards the end of session and then also into the special session. So what this is a summary of the provisions that applied to each of the plans when they were included in the bill. And we expect that the bill that the Pension Commission will consider will include all of the plans, although that is up to the chair and everybody on the commission here as to whether that will be the case. But this is a summary of the provisions that were we consider the benefit reform provisions as well as the contribution increases and state aids that were in the bills. The color coding, I'll just describe. I won't go through this in depth because it's a little bit detailed, and certainly if you have questions, we can talk about that. But the color coding is that the yellow is the changes made to the COLA, and you will notice that every single plan had the provision that would eliminate the COLA trigger. And then depending on the plan, there was also a reduction in the COLA. The annual COLA, the cost of living increase, or post-retirement adjustment. So those are the yellow items. The blue, I'll skip to the green quickly, just to indicate that the green is for the money. So the contribution increases and the state aids that were in the bills. So those are the green items. The lavender items are the actuarial changes. All of the plans had the same actuarial changes, which was to extend the amortization period, as well as decrease the rate of return from their current rate of 8 or 8.5 to 7.5. So the blue item is the blue items are the ones that really change from plan to plan the most. The first one under MSRS General is the one that has this description here contains all of the changes that appear for a number of the plans, but not all of them. The primary ones here relate to the deferral that we talked about earlier, the augmentation on deferred vested benefits. All the plans have that provision that eliminates that going forward. There's also changes to the way early retirement benefits are calculated, which would remove the augmentation that's baked into that calculation, as well as a deferral of the start of the COLA until normal retirement age. So those are the two kind of early retirement changes. And then the final blue item that appears, I believe, in all of them is to reduce the interest rate that is paid on refunds from 4% to 3%. So as you look through this, you'll see that the blue section is either smaller or the same, depending on whether the bill included the full array of changes or not. And you'll see that the public safety plans tended to not have as many of the blue changes. Early retirement for those plans were pretty much untouched.
Thank you, Ms. Lencheski. Any other follow-ups or questions for Ms. Lencheski by members? Seeing none, I think we are now to the point where we're bringing up each of the individual plans to visit with their proposals. And the first one will have come forward from MSRS, Ms. Leonard, as she's making her way to the testifying table.
Welcome, Ms. Leonard. I hope you're feeling better, too. Everybody's kind of sketchy around here.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I do have a bit of a cold, so I apologize. And hopefully people get healthier as we move down the list.
Hope so, too.
So my goals for today, I don't have a lot to report, but I did want to share our funded status update, summarize some of the changes that were in the 2017 omnibus bill, and how that impacts our projections. And then just kind of go through, remind everybody what happened in 2017 and the cost of the veto in foregone revenue and additional COLAs that were paid to retirees. So if you go to slide 2, this is our financial status update. The 8% numbers are actually from our actuarial valuation, so those are posted on our website and available publicly. The 7.5 are estimates and will be presented to our board next week. So for our general plan, we do have $12.5 billion in assets. We do have that unfunded liability of $2 billion. At 7.5%, it's closer to $2.8 billion. And our funded ratio goes down to 81.5 at 7.5 rate of return. Our contribution deficiency on a market value basis at 7.5 is close to 4.3%. And just to give you an idea of the cost to go to 7.5, it's an $800 million cost and 2.3% of pay. Just all reminders. Our correctional plan at 7.5% is 68.1% funded with a 9.9% deficiency, although better than last year. And then for our state patrol plan, it is 7.2% deficient and 76% funded. So in total, the cost to move to 7.5 is about 7.5 assumed rate of return is about $911 million, which is less than last year. Last year it was $931 million. So the 15.1% did help us in that aspect. The next slide shows our projections if we were to do nothing based on our fiscal year 17 results. So our general employees line is going downward. Our correctional slope is also going downward, although both are better than last year because of that increased return this year. And then our state patrol plan is flat. Last year it was going downward. Now it's flat if we were to do nothing. Partially that's because it's such a small plan. There's so much volatility. And the liabilities are on the retiree side. 60% of the liabilities are on the retiree side. So when we see those big investment returns, it really impacts that plan much more quickly. But if we see returns that are negative, it also impacts them more quickly on the negative side as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
So just to clarify, the slide number 3, the header on it is a little bit misleading in terms of my opinion, because the 7.5% assumption after 15.1% return is under current statute, with no changes from or elaborating on what could have been. So this is just with the 7.5%, which you have adopted.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we have not yet adopted the 7.5% because it's not in statute yet. But we do try to relay both the 8% and 7.5% numbers. So this is if we, in today's world, based on our actuarial valuations, after the 15.1%, where we sit if we were at a 7.5 assumed rate of return.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Albright.
So, but the point being is that you're not taking into consideration any of the other effective changes that were in the 17 pension bill, excepting the change in the actuarial assumption rate.
Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, that's correct. Later in the slides, I'll show you what the impact of the full bill would look like. On
so,
those projections.
Madam Chair, just a quick reminder for the people on the commission. When an actuarial assumption is done, they do not assume or put into their calculus the actual rate of return. The only thing that they take a look at is liability, the assumed rate of return, and the census that is applicable to that pension plan. Actual rate of return is not to be construed as success for the plan or anything. It's just an assumption of what the cost of the plan based upon primarily liability. So I think that the commission should look more concertedly at those factors than the rate of return that was realized last year.
Ms. Leonard? Representative O'Driscoll? No? Okay.
Madam Chair, if we move to slide four, this is our general plan. This is the 2017 omnibus bill, the provisions that were in the bill, and the impact on the plan itself as far as savings. So if the reamortization saves 0.4% of pay, reducing the COLA, the final bill, the board's original proposal had 1.5%. The 2017 omnibus bill had 1% for 5 years, 1.5% thereafter. And then there were a phase-in of contributions from employees of 0.5% and employers from 0.75%. Also, the removal of deferred augmentation for future and the refund interest reduction saved about 0.4%. And the removing deferred augmentation from the early retirement factors and delaying that COLA saves 0.4%. In total, if the bill had passed, we would have a 0.4% sufficiency in contributions in this plan. If what that means is if we had passed the bill, our projections would project us to be over 100% funded for the general employee's retirement plan based on all of the assumptions, including the 7.5%. The other thing I would note is the 2017 omnibus bill. The board's original proposal had a reduction in liabilities of a total of about $750 million. The final bill included liability reductions of $1.1 billion. So a pretty significant reduction in liabilities that were contained in the bill itself. If you look to the next slide, this shows both last year and this year and kind of shows that, yes, the assumptions, this shows the assumptions going forward and the impact of a good rate of return year, but it could also go the other direction. So the solid blue line is where our general plan is projected today based on all the assumptions except for including the 7.5%, because that is part of the proposal. The light blue line is the bubble, so that was last year's trajectory. So before the Pension Commission took action, before the boards came proposal, that's what our fiscal year 16 trajectory looked like. The dotted blue line, the dark blue line going upward, shows if the pension bill would have passed and become law, where our funded trajectory would be, and that it would exceed 100% funding in our amortization period. And the lighter blue dotted line shows if the bill had passed last year under last year's circumstances without the 15.1%, we still would have exceeded 90% funded. So it kind of gives you a picture of all the what-if scenarios for the general plan specifically. The next slide just shows our correctional plan. So the board's proposal did include mainly employee and employer contribution increases, a supplemental contribution increase for the employer, and a reduction in cost of living adjustments for the retirees. For the most part, that was what the commission adopted as part of their package, except for they also included the removal of deferred augmentation. There, you don't see as much savings in this plan for the removal of deferred augmentation, primarily because most folks are career employees and they don't get deferred augmentation. They stay with the plan until they retire. had this bill been adopted in statute, the correctional projections would be over, also over 100%, nearing almost about 108, 109%. What that means, so the supplemental contributions of 4.45% that were phased in would cease after the fund reached 100% funding. So it was a little hard to predict the projections because that contribution would stop, but it does, it would mean that those contributions wouldn't continue the full amortization period if all assumptions were to come true. The next slide talks about our state patrol plan. So I mentioned that the State Patrol plan is very volatile because it is a small plan. It's also the liabilities are highly on the retiree side. The board's original proposal included employee and employer contribution increases and a supplemental contribution from the employer. These provisions were mostly adopted by the Pension Commission with the inclusion of the deferred augmentation removal. This plan almost virtually has zero deferred members because people who do work in the State Patrol plan continue on into that plan until retirement for the most part, or they often have combined service with PERA police and fire. So there's really no savings for that particular provision. Again, this plan, because of its volatility, will see big swings. And if the pension bill were to have been adopted last year would have exceeded 100% funding within the amortization period, about 110% funding. But again, because of the volatility, it can swing very quickly back and forth each year. So the nutshell on the next slide is if the pension bill had passed last year or if we move forward with a similar proposal this year, all plans would exceed 100% funding within the amortization period. All plans also would see a contribution sufficiency in their actuarial valuations. There would be fewer years of supplemental contributions for the public safety plans. And then the total reduction in liabilities or benefits would have been more than $1.2 billion with the packages that were brought forward. And then the last slide just kind of summarizes the impact without the pension bill. We did pay a 2% COLA to our general plan members and our correctional plan members, which did cost additional about $7.9 million. We did have foregone revenue from contributions, $8.8 million from employees and $16.4 million from employers. And then, as we've already gone through, there's contribution deficiencies for all plans, and our projections are in the downward or flat going forward. Our board did meet in November. We have not adopted a new 2018 proposal. They came forward in 2017 with their proposal, which was modified by the Pension Commission and the legislature. And there was a request to wait until after the forecast to even come up with anything new, if there was going to be anything new. I think generally, as we've been talking to stakeholders, they're generally supportive. I think folks believe in the sustainability of these plans and believe it's important in the future for these to be available to our active members, our retiring members, and future employees in the, of the state. I think there's, as the commissioner mentioned, there's some discomfort about deferred augmentation. But I think there's people understand both sides of that situation. So that is the end of my comments. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I appreciate Ms. Leonard, your review. It was very good. I also appreciate your comments and review of what the board is saying and if there was any changes going forward. And I hope all the other directors handle it that way. Is there any questions for Ms. Leonard? Good. Thank you very much for your work.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Have a good day.
With that, we'll have Mr. Anderson with PERA come up. Good morning, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commission members. A little concerned about what's on this microphone.
You should be.
Appreciate the opportunity to address you today and bring you some news about the proposals from our board. These are a long time in the making, particularly with the general plan and the correctional plan. Police and fire is largely reaffirming the positions from last year, but for the general plan and correctional plan, It goes back to 2 years ago, and we spent a year with our board educating them about the many features of a pension plan. We spent separate sessions talking about normal and early retirement benefits. We talked about ancillary benefits like death and disability. We talked about post-retirement adjustments. We talked about funding, a lot of education about what is good plan design, what is bad plan design. And since the general plan in particular was on a path towards improved funding a year ago, the board wanted to continue to evaluate and bring something forward in 2018, and we appreciate that we had the opportunity. Ultimately, we're out of the final bill last year, so we can come back and work through the remainder of the process, which we have done here, which included evaluating the new numbers, July 2017, understanding GASB and how that works and what that means, developing a new proposal for the general and correctional plans in the summer, and working with stakeholders over the last 4 or 5 months to refine that proposal into something that is broadly supported by these groups. And noting just on page 2, the support from the stakeholder groups for these proposals, the one note that I would have with related to the general plan is that the general plan proposal has a lot of complex features to it, a lot of different components to it, I should say. SEIU was supportive of most of those changes, including what we're proposing for the COLA change, but wasn't ready yet to support the early retirement augmentation change. Aside from that, all of the stakeholder groups that are actively involved with the process were supportive of the changes that we're proposing today. And those changes, for all plans, would result in all of these plans being fully funded within 25 years. And for the general and correctional plan, it would achieve that without any additional funding, whether that's from employees, employers, or from the state. And I'd like to move hopefully fairly rapidly through the first half of this discussion and save a little bit more time for the second half when we talk about specifically the general and correctional plan, because there's more for you to absorb at that time. But on page 3 is just the board at the December meeting did just reaffirm the position to propose moving to a 7.5% investment return. Not really a surprise there for us. We did have a letter from our actuary, Gabriel Roeder Smith, received in September to the board that noted that the 8% statutory rate is outside of the range of reasonableness for them for the pair evaluations in 2017. We have been, for our financial statements, we have been using 7.5% since that's a rate that we can use at our discretion. And all the results that I'm going to show to you in this presentation are based on a 7.5% assumption.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot of information on this slide, and Mr. Anderson, I'd like to just go through a couple of those with you, if you wouldn't mind. So the first one is, under the first bullet point, it talks about an inflation feature. And, you know, inflation has gotten a lot of press lately in terms of its increase or its volatility. So I'm wondering if you can explain for the commission what that 2.5% inflationary feature is. Is it just the last 10 years, or is it rolling periods? What goes into the – what's the factoring that goes into in terms of putting that inflation feature together?
Okay. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for that question. And historically, the inflation assumption has just been a component of the investment return and hasn't had its own significant impact. But it is important to what we're going to be talking about later for our general plans. The assumption that the actuaries develop and recommend for us, they look at three different things. They look at the capital market assumptions. So our actuary went out and they went to 8 different investment consulting firms and asked them, what is your long-term forecast? And when they did that, the average expectation from those firms was 2.27%. And know that typically the firms look at a shorter period. I don't know exactly what they mean by shorter period, but they did note that. They also look at the 2017 Social Security Trustees report This is the Social Security's report, not about what actual increases have been given in the past. It's the trustee's report about forecasting the future for solvency purposes of Social Security administration system. So their forecast is a long-term forecast, and they were assuming 2.6%. And then lastly, the actuary looks at Treasury inflation-protected securities. And I don't precisely know how they look at that, but that does give them an indication of inflation expectations over a 30-year period, and that was lower. That was 1.8%. So the actuaries look at all of this, kind of balance those expectations, and they developed an assumption recommendation for us of 2.5%.
Mr. Albright, Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your second bullet point talks to Gabriel Roeder and Smith, the actuary that you're using, and it says that they believe an 8% statutory rate is outside the reasonable range for par evaluations. Did they also discuss with you when they made presentation of the report what that range looks like? I mean, where are we at 7.5% in construct of the acceptable range that an actuary would look at for a pension plan of this nature?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I believe in the letter that is in your packet, I believe they had the range as 6.85% up to 7.68%. This is a letter from them. It's dated September 11th.
Mr. Anderson, do you have a copy? Do you have a...
So on the,
okay, that's the GRS Retirement Consulting.
It's a GRS Retirement Consulting letter dated September 11th, and I'm... yeah, on page 6 of that letter. And in the middle of that page, there's comments and recommendations in bold.
So, Representative Albright.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and that that's very helpful, Mr. Anderson. We're still on the high end of that range, and you know from 6.85 to 7.6, but at least we're getting into the target zone. Did they give you any additional guidance in terms of where they thought the 7.5% is that a final step, or is it? Did they suggest even further consideration of a lower rate,
Mr. Henderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the communication that we receive from them typically is more in the terms of a range, and we did not have further discussion about how that range may change prospectively.
I think my answer, actually, Representative Anderson, was helpful to me in reading without my glasses as well, that their guidance is to the last sentence in that paragraph, 7% would be more likely to be sustainable for the longer period. So there is some benefit in looking at that on an ongoing basis. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Mr. Anderson, any other further questions? Okay. Wonderful.
Okay, Madam Chair, advancing on to the police and fire proposal on page 5. In short, the stakeholders and the board unanimously was approving and reaffirming the support for what was in the bill last year. So that included a 1% employee contribution that would be phased in, a 1.5% employer contribution that would be phased in, and state contributions of $4.5 million. In fiscal year 18, $4.5 million fiscal year 19, and $9 million per year thereafter. It is presumed by the board that the transition dates would shift here. But generally, the board was reaffirming support for last year's position. And on page 6 shows why the proposal is in place in the first place. The red line is the forecast from 2016, which shows that the funding ratio would be expected to gradually decrease. The blue line reflects the positive investment return of fiscal year 17, so the forecast improved. But you can see a lot of volatility here. in the forecast. So 1 year of investment return changes this plan quite a bit. This plan is more volatile than most because it has a low ratio of active members to retired members, only 1.1 active per retiree. And the proposal would put this on a path as shown by the black line, heading to fully fund the plan within 25 years on a path to get to 109% in a 30-year period. And while that's certainly improvement, I think further support of why this change is necessary has to do with the volatility. And with the volatility of this plan, we particularly see that with the GASB results, which were far more volatile in this plan than what we see in other plans. This is on the next page, page 7. It's just a summary of the GASB results from the last 3 years for the police and fire plan. The top row is liabilities, middle row is assets, third row is unfunded liability. Most of the volatility is on the top row, how the liability is measured. It's a 30% increase in the liability estimate from 15 to 16, and then it came back down in 2016. So I know a lot of people believe the asset is what drives the volatility, and it's a contributing factor, the market value measure, that's going to be volatile. But it's really the liability volatility that can be up to 5 times as much from year to year, and we saw in this plan. And it all has to do with whether that funding ratio line is going up or down. If the funding ratio line is going up, you can have asset gains or losses, and it's not going to affect that liability measurement. If that funding ratio goes from being positive to negative, GASB reacts differently and enforces a different measurement of the liability. And it enforces the use of different discount rates. And that's where we can see a lot of volatility in that number. And the volatility is important because rating agencies can look at that. And we get that feedback from the cities. We've heard it from school districts. Even heard discussion about municipal liquor stores who hear reference of GASB pension numbers and how that works. So GASB, very, very complicated. I know we've had discussion about it already, and I only want to point it out here as further evidence that ensuring that a line is headed in the proper direction is going to help eliminate this volatility issue from further discussions. So moving on to the general employees proposal, I'd like to start with the results. So on page 9, going back, the red line was what the forecast looked like in 2016. And there's progress, but not as much as we would like. The orange line shows the impact of the positive return, the 15.1% return. And typically, you would see better progress from that, from a very positive asset return. But you don't hear because of the effect of the trigger to go to a higher COLA. The positive return improves the funding status, which would move up the trigger date to when the 2.5% annual increase to retirees would occur. So the trigger date from those returns move the plan up from 2053 to 2045. That can sound like it's a far way out. And for our current retirees, they certainly would say that's a long way out. But for any member under 40, under this forecast, they would expect to get a full 2.5% increase for their entire retirement. It's a valuable benefit. It has real value. But you don't get the funding increase if every time you gain on the assets, you're increasing on the liability. So that trigger is problematic. It's problematic for two reasons. One is it prevents you from reaching full funding quicker. But it's also problematic, from my view, is that it's bad design on how you distribute benefits to retirees. One whole generation may get a 1% increase. Another generation may get a 2.5% increase for their entire retirement. All of that has nothing to do with what actual inflation is. It's a questionable design. It wasn't intended to be that way because when it was put in place in 2010, the expectation is that it would trigger up in a pretty short time. So the proposal addresses that plan design element. And the proposal in its entirety increases the sustainability of the plan, better improves funding by improving the funding ratio at a better rate. It's the black line here, and it would move the plan to be fully funded within 25 years and a target of 109% in the 30-year period. So how we got there with the stakeholder support is on page 10, is we talked about where the money goes, where it comes from, and where it goes. And this plan is, it has a 6.5% employee contribution and 7.5% employer contribution, 14.0% of pay coming into the plan. On the right-hand side is how that 14% is distributed. Starting at the top, 6.2% goes to provide the normal retirement benefit and what I call fairly reduced early retirement benefits. And by fairly reduced, I mean it's actuarial equivalent based only on investment assumptions and mortality assumptions. So if you retire early, you get a lesser benefit because you're getting it for a longer period of time. It doesn't include the augmentation. And then we value a 1% increase in what we'd refer to this as a core benefit. The next item is 0.7%. That's the cost of the future trigger to go to 2.5%. In dollar value, it's close to $500 million of value to those future retirees down the road. Valuable benefit. The next item is the 1% annual inflation increase that would go to an early retiree until age 66. And then the next component, 0.4%, is the value of the augmentation in the early retirement benefit. And then there's 1% of pay that goes to fund disability benefits, pre-retirement death benefits, refunds to terminated members, and operating expenses. All of those are benefits. What remains of that 14% contribution is 5.6%. That's what goes to improve the funding status. It goes to eliminate the unfunded liability. It goes to provide future benefit security. It provides some protection in case there's an assumption change in the future or a recession or something else is there to protect the core benefits. That's the current status. Then what we talked about with stakeholders is what's important to you? What do you value? And it's sustainability. It's security. We hear that time and again. They want this plan to be there in the future. They want it to be. They want security for those core benefits. They want to have some inflation protection for the retirees. For the groups, talk about augmentation. Is that important to have? And generally, the reaction is augmentation is something everyone is contributing for, but fewer and fewer people are getting it, and it's for people who choose to retire early. And the stakeholders would rather have that money directed towards protecting the core benefit. The other components of augmentation for deferred members and the interest credit had very little financial impact in the discussion, and since augmentation for deferred members had already been removed for para members that terminated after 2012. That wasn't very large part of the discussion with any of the stakeholder groups. So given that question of what's coming in and where should these contributions go, if you look at the options at that point, is kind of two parts to this component. One is want to preserve the post-retirement inflation protection, the 0.7%, want to preserve that, but find a better structure for that. If it's a bad design that doesn't have equity between generations, let's have a better design for that, but preserve that value. And the other components, those can be removed, and that funding can go to improve the funding status. So two components to the proposal. And that's how we can improve the funding status without additional contributions, and do it in a way that more equitably balances the benefits to the members. The next question is, if you're changing the post-retirement component, what do you change it to? A proposal to just eliminate it wouldn't provide any protection. Stakeholders would not be supportive of that. A proposal to move to what either TRA or MSRS has as their proposal would actually increase the cost from the current point. And that wouldn't meet our goals of trying to provide more benefit security for the core benefits. What we want is a cost neutral to the current protection. We want a cost neutral approach, which would translate to an increase averaging about 1.25% per year. That's the cost neutral to the current, which is 50% of the inflation assumption. And that's the start of the proposal, is to tie it to 50% of inflation. But the stakeholders expressed concern about wanting to make sure they have a minimum amount of protection, so we introduced a 1% floor to that proposal. And we need to make sure we're containing costs, and so there's a 1.5% cap to this proposal. So the result is the increase would be 50% of CPI, not less than 1%, not more than 1.5%. The long-term expected increase would expect to be 1.25% a year, but always be somewhere in between that gap. And so just putting this all together, page 12 really takes what I described already and summarizes it in one place, in that the all of the reforms suggested by the legislature proposal from last year, including removing the trigger, would be accomplished. All the others would be accomplished, provided that the value of that inflation protection for our retirees can be used in a different way. The value retained and just redistributed in a way that's more equitable and better ties to inflation.
Members, Mr. Anderson, before we go any further, any questions on that CPI proposal? I'm sure we will have some questions, and we'll be continuing this discussion. I give you great credit, Mr. Anderson. I think this is a very out-of-the-box type of thinking. And I know you've done a lot of work over the interim to thread this needle, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I could go on with the correctional plan. And just the makeup of the correctional plan is, it's a, relative to our general plan, it's much, much smaller. It has less than 1,000 retirees. It does have about 4,000 actives. It's relatively newer because the plan's been around for 20 years, so it has a high ratio of actives to retirees. And the only component of the discussion is the post-retirement increase, which has the same trigger approach with the other plans. But what's different about this plan is that it's the 2.5% has been triggered, and that these retirees have been receiving 2.5% since 2015. And the plan is giving that because it's in a relatively higher position. It's been close to 100% funded under the old assumptions. Under the 7.5% assumption, it's still 87% funded, which would be forecast if all the assumptions are perfectly met in the future, which we know they won't. But if they're perfectly met, it's the green line on page 14, and that higher COLA would not trigger off. Because for it to trigger off under current provisions, funding would have to drop below 80% 1 year or 85% for two consecutive years. So perfect meeting of the assumptions, it wouldn't trigger off. If the assumptions are exceeded, if the returns are better than 7.5%, it would stay on and the funding would improve. The proposal that we have would ensure that the funding will improve. That's a positive result of the proposal. And it also has the same kind of format that we're proposing for the general plan of connecting it to inflation with a 1% floor and a 1.5% cap ultimately. The additional feature, which I admit adds a little bit of complication, but in fairness to the current retirees who are receiving the value, and that this is a better funded plan, and there is the potential that it can continue in that position, the proposal proposes to have a higher cap apply. It's still the same format. The proposal is that the it'd be 100% of inflation increase, not less than 1%, not more than 2.5%, and that would apply as long as the plan stays in that favorable position. If it triggers off under the same trigger mechanism, if it triggers off, that cap would drop down to 1.5. And these are consistent minimums with the general plan and actually consistent with the MSRS plan and the TRA plan of having 1% minimum has a consistent maximum of 1.5. Difference here is that you'd only get the maximum if inflation dictates it rather than automatically going to it. Once this plan would trigger off, we would not propose a new trigger. So it is a goal of ultimately wanting the triggers to go away, but to try to preserve this. And this was an important component to gaining stakeholder support from the member groups, is to preserve the possibility for the higher increases while the plan stays in a positive funding position.
Super. Questions from Mr. Anderson? I'm sure that we will be continuing this conversation, Mr. Anderson, and I really appreciate your work on this. Good job.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we have two more funds to go through. Before Mr. Stoffel with the teachers, TRA, if you could come up, that'd be great. While he's working his way up, members, we're going to have at least two more meetings before the start of the session. Get some of the things done. I'd like to have a lot of this agenda complete before we continue on. And, of course, then we have to find out the February forecast. But we're also going to look at some pension plan reforms and defined contribution alternatives. We're going to look at the sustainability of Minnesota's pension plans, stress testing, and have Representative Vogel, you've been very active in that, and perhaps have some representation from the Pew Foundation. And then we have our bills to consider for the next session, and we have the LCPR housekeeping bill we have to vote on also. So we do have some work before the start of session, and you will be getting some alternatives on some dates that I appreciate a review back, and we'll go from there. Welcome, Mr. Stoffel. You, too, have been working over the interim. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Glad to be with you. And I can report that my cold was a month ago, so I'm ready and raring to go this morning. So I'm working from the presentation that we put together for the Pension Commission. And on page slide 2 is a list of some of the goals we've laid out for for the TRA board for this session. We have 4 main goals, and the first one is to keep working on a sustainability bill. We've been at this for a couple years. We'll continue the effort. We are really interested in working with the Pension Commission, with the legislature, with the governor's staff to get something together that works for all parties. We have a set of principles that I'll cover in a second. Anything that we evaluate, we like to look at it in relation to the 4 principles that we set out in 2016. And that helps us determine how we view what's being proposed. Number 2 on our list of goals is if there is any increase in employer funding, to get that or increase in employer contribution rates, to get the state funding necessary behind that so that the schools don't just absorb any new employer costs. State funding is very important for the schools, the public schools, the charter schools, for any new employer contribution that might be included in any proposal. Number three, approve a 7.5% investment return assumption. You may be surprised to hear me saying this, but I will say a little bit more about it later on another slide, but we are now proposing to go to 7.5%. We had a different position last year, and I can explain why a little bit more, but we are now proposing that be adopted, and our board did approve that in December at their meeting. And number four, we really have a need to get the administrative bills passed that we've presented for the last two sessions. They've been included in the pension bills, but there's a lot of real important provisions in the administrative bills. There's some IRS conformity language. There's things in there for individuals. There's just a lot of operational things that we've been waiting for in the administrative bill that's really critical. And, you know, we really have that as a high priority also for this legislative session. So those are our underlying four goals for the session. And on slide three are the principles that I referred to earlier. And I'll just quickly cover the four principles that we have been looking at since 2016. Number one, shared commitment. Anything that's developed in a proposal, really, you know, we have three stakeholder groups, our retirees, our active members, and our employer groups / taxpayer. Those are the three stakeholder groups that we really need shared commitment as we view any proposal. Intergenerational equity, a benefit earned should be a benefit paid for at that time. Long-term financial goals, getting the fund on track from a financial and actuarial perspective within a reasonable period of time. And then maintaining the recruitment and retention value of a defined benefit pension plan. So those are the four core principles that we use when we're evaluating any principles. So the next slide is the news that I can report. Since last session, we decided that rather than wait for the next experience study to be prepared, which is really 2 years from now, we're obligated to do a full-blown experience study every 4 years. We did one 2 years ago. The next one will be 2 years from now. So we did a special study, or what we're calling a mini experience study. We didn't evaluate all the assumptions, but we looked specifically and only at the economic assumptions. So they're all included on the slide on page four. So what's included in that analysis was the long-term investment return, price inflation, wage inflation, payroll growth, and salary growth. Those were the only things that were analyzed in the report. And what was delivered to us in November and what was adopted by the TRA board in December was a new set of assumptions that we're recommending to the Pension Commission. The 7.5% is now what we are in favor of proposing, and we're behind that return assumption going forward. That is set in law, so we need a bill passed to make that happen. The remaining items 2 through 5 on the list are meant to work along with that assumption, and I really have to point out that this is a set of assumptions that make sense together as a cohesive set. If we just change one or two or a few of these, things get out of whack actuarially, and the actuaries really stress the point that this is a set of assumptions that work together. So the price inflation and wage inflation, payroll growth, and salary increase assumptions are also being recommended to change. So those are the new assumptions that we'll be proposing. Number one, again, needs to be included in the bill passed by the legislature. 2 through 5, the board has authority to set those assumptions. Then we report that change to the Pension Commission. If nothing is done, then they go into effect. But we would like to make it contingent, any change to 2 through 5 contingent on the change in number one occurring to 7.5%. So on slide 5, we have an updated financial status report. And actually, as far as we're concerned, we are still bound in state law to be calculating things at 8.5%. The TRA fund has never gone to 8%. We were in a select and ultimate period for 5 years where we went down to 8% for a time, and it ratcheted back up. So now we are currently at 8.5% today. So we can't ignore that. We have to report that way. But everything else that we're doing, including our annual financial report, where we have some discretion on what assumption to use in that report, we're using 7.5%. Everything I'm reporting to you today is at 7.5%. And so that's the way we're viewing things going forward. So if we take a look at our status today at a 7.5% return assumption, along with the other assumptions, the new package that has been recommended, this is the way the TRA fund looks on slide 5. So our liability is $30 billion. We have assets of $21.3 billion. That's as of July 1, 2017. So our unfunded liability, using these new assumptions, $9.1 billion. We're 70.1% funded. That is sort of close to the average for a public pension fund today, somewhere around 70%. But the direction that we're heading is the concern. We're projected in 30 years, if we do nothing, to be heading towards a 52% funded ratio. So that's where the focus is. That's the attention that we need on the plan. As far as contribution rates, the actuaries are recommending a 23% rate. Just about 16% is coming into the plan, so there's a 7% shortage on contributions, which can be made up with either higher contributions or reduced benefits. So that's the challenge. It looks like we're heading to 52% over the long term, and we have a shortage on contribution rates or reduced benefits, some combination thereof, that would resolve that 7% shortage. So the slide on page 6 is really just a graphic representation of the current situation. Again, heading to 52% funded, using the 7.5% return assumption and all the other new assumptions that have been recommended. And then the last slide really that I'm here to address is what things would look like if something like Senate File 545, which passed the Senate last year, would be passed. We would be on a trajectory towards 92% funded, and that's a package of changes that would get the fund on the correct trajectory. We would be taking $2 billion off of the liability side of off of the books. What was included in that legislation was very significant. There were reductions to cost of living adjustments, increases to employee and employer contribution rates. Those were the very key components, the more significant components of that legislation, and it would get the fund on track and eliminate $2 billion from the liability side. So again, we don't have a specific new package that we're titling our 2018 legislative package, but we're here to, report. We're now, we've got a new set of recommendations, actuarial assumptions that we're ready to and suggest that those be adopted, and we're ready to work with the Pension Commission on something similar to Senate File 545, things that work. We've been continually meeting with our stakeholder groups throughout the last year, communicating with them, letting them know what the status is, and trying to get their input and their feedback as well. So we want to take your direction and work with the governor's office and be flexible with what we can do here.
Mr. Stoffel, how much is this package? How much does this package cost?
The package, the Senate File, Madam Chair, the Senate File 545 is the package. For TRA, there was a 1.25% employer increase, and that was phased in over 6 years. In each of those 6 years, it was about $10 million, roughly $10 million per year phased in. So by that sixth year, it would have been $60 million, actually $64 million in the sixth year. The employee side had a 0.25% increase, so we would go from 7.5 to 7.75, and that was also phased in, but it was like a one-time phase-in in that sixth year is when that would have gone into effect.
So, and Representative Deason, I know you have a question, but real briefly, basically the only difference between last year's proposal and this year is you're going down the assumed rate of return to 7.5. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And as I said, we don't specifically have a proposal that we're making today. I mean, we're here. We're interested in talking about Senate Files 545 or anything else that is going to be proposed. But, yes, we're here to report the change in agreeing with the 7.5% return assumption and, just the willingness. We really want to, work with the legislature to get something done here.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, on the economic assumption changes, can you just tell me which direction those changes push the unfunded liability? I don't, not amounts, but just Do they all make it greater?
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, 7.5% is by and far away the largest one that will make that, will increase the liability side. That adds about $3 billion to the liabilities. Well, I guess the whole set does, but that is the largest part that affects that. And I think, well, I don't think I've seen anything that really breaks it apart specifically which way they all go. I think they all trend in the same way, but the investment return assumption is the one that's the largest that takes it in that direction.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Stoffel. Thank you for your work, too, through the interim. Ms. Schertz, St. Paul Teachers Association.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
And members of the Commission, and thank you to the last two speakers for not being physically ill. I still feel like I might need to wipe this area down, but we'll see what happens.
Handy wipes. Lysol.
Any of you that have teenage children know that when they choose to speak to you in the morning, it's usually a good thing, but you're never quite sure what they're going to say. And I was happy that today my teenager, maybe she's seen me in business casual too often, she stopped in the hallway and looked at me and said, "Where are you going today?" And I said, "Well, I have to testify today." And then she stopped, and I was surprised she kept talking to me. And she said, "Testify, well, why are you doing that?" And I said, "Well, you know, we're trying, I think, to secure retirement benefits and a more stable plan for 12,000 St. Paul teachers." She paused for a few seconds and was actually thoughtful and said, "Well, that seems like a good thing." And I thought, well, that's it. The whole day is good from that point on. If my 15-year-old can get that, then it's all that's okay. Good. So with that, you know, before I say anything else, I just want to express gratitude on behalf of myself and our 12,000 members and our board in particular for your efforts last year in the legislature, because at the end of the day, we came exceptionally close to passing a bill that I think really would have made a tremendous difference for pensions generally, but very specifically to St. Paul teachers. As we think about this year, it's our great hope and our plan to do everything that we can to get that same bill passed this next year, because I think it was quite an exceptional bill. And exceptional because it achieved a number of core objectives. And I'll just dive right in, but the headline is, you've heard an awful lot last year about what we're about to say, so I'll try to keep it fairly short. But on the first page, we do outline what we believe are the key objectives and how we'd like to get there. You know, our objectives remain the same, addressing the cost of mortality, our package of changes that come with an experience study that goes into effect this year. Key among those changes, mortality and the investment return assumption. We joined with several other funds early in the process and moved ours to 8. We've been very supportive of the structural change to 7.5. We think it is good for the funds. We also want to continue to address basically a historic shortfall in contributions. And while pensions are complicated, we always do say at the end of the day, the simple part of it is you have to balance assets and liabilities. And if you don't have enough coming in contributions, you can't run a stable program. As well, when we get the contribution levels to where they should be to meet our requirements, we also need to continue to focus on what's our funded ratio, because we could get our current contribution levels to the right point, but if we haven't addressed our funded ratio level, we'll continue to be vulnerable. And I won't spend too much time on it because you've heard several speakers address that when you have some of these smaller plans at lower funded ratios. They tend to be very volatile when they're in those 60 to 70% ranges. So we have a vested interest for long-term security to see that funded ratio improvement is accelerated. And at the end of the day, I try to keep my focus on protecting core benefits, not just for the teachers that are in retirement now, that's incredibly important, but for our active teachers today and for future generations, because I think that, again, not to beat this horse, we do have a retirement crisis here in the United States. we have a plan here that can function very well. It just requires us to constantly make good financial decisions. So protecting that is incredibly important. It does require that we make hard choices and that we communicate effectively and educate our members and our constituents about those choices. On the right-hand side, how we would like to get there is basically last year's bill. We think that bill accomplished an awful lot, including the structural changes. It provided the funding that we'll talk more about. It did include significant cost savings measures. We think that's important. And at the end of the day, it took this fund to a full funding status. It remedied the historic contribution shortfall, and it created equity between the employee and the employer contribution rates. Again, I won't go into the details, but not passing this bill last year did cost the fund substantially and just delayed one more year of correcting a very serious situation. If I turn to the next page, on the left-hand side, really this is just meant to walk you through, I think, the board. And before I took this seat, the board has been, I think, very focused on their fiduciary duties, being good stewards of the fund. If you look at from 2012, actions that they have taken have done an awful lot to take the deficiency from what had been on a market value 7% on an actuarial 6, all the way down this past year to 0.66 and 0.52. That required them to make hard choices. They made changes to the early retirement augmentation. They went to a 1% COLA and stayed there, and some other changes. Those were hard decisions, but you can see that there is a benefit to making those decisions. There's improvement. Now, fast forward, we can't ignore the fact that notwithstanding those improvements, as you have heard, all of these assumption changes do create a different picture. And when we do take into account mortality and 7.5%, the real numbers are a 4+% deficiency, and that compels us to act. As we look on the right-hand side, I think this echoes some of the comments that have been made. If we didn't look at the reality that we face today, we'd say the top line, this blue line, is where we are. That's not really where we are, though, and that's not what we should focus on. If we looked at that, we'd say, well, ultimately, we're going to go to 90. We can afford to just drift there over time. But the reality is that's not the real number. The real number is the red line. When we take into account all of these assumptions, the red line is the real number, and it means that if I did that today, if I shocked the system today, instead of saying I'm around 65% funded, I'd be saying I'm around 60% funded, and I would have a line trending down over time. And we stop it here at 55, but the line doesn't turn up later. It keeps going down. That's not good for the state. It's not good for St. Paul. It's not good for the members, and taking action is certainly the right answer. I've provided the next page as just a snapshot of what some of the key statistics I look at. The top grouping, this is just looking over time, the last, decade plus, how has this funded ratio on both an actuarial and market value basis trended? And the reality is it's trended in this sort of 60 to 70% channel, and it can't break out because of the historic underfunding. And if we don't address that, that's the channel we're likely to stay in, again, which leaves us vulnerable. In the middle section, that's just a graphical layout of our employee and our employer regular contributions, and we've talked about this before. We appreciate the support of our sponsor. They are with us through this and have done a great job helping us through this process. But for the last, since 2000, our employees have actually paid 1% more. It's the only plan in the state where the employees have paid more. We'd like to correct that. And then at the bottom, you can see the sort of COLA history over the last decade plus. And again, I think this represents some difficult and courageous decisions where the board brought it down to 1% and kept it there. We'll talk about the nuances of the proposal a little bit more, but a pressure point here is this proposal in return for a fulsome funding package. These retirees are willing to sacrifice for really their active members and do a two-year COLA freeze. I think that's a huge sacrifice. I commend the board and the retirees for being able to do that. And again, that was in return for seeing a full funding package. So when we turn to the next page, there's a lot of information here, but I think this summarizes the financial statistics of the 2017 Omnibus Pension Bill. We start with, at the top, a 0.7% deficiency. we recognize the assumption changes that need to be made, and then we take a look at the policy choices, really, I think, as Mr. Anderson laid out quite nicely. What are the policy choices that we can make to try to address some of these? We've laid these out in detail. I won't go through each one of them. But when we think about the policy choices, how do we want to spend the fund's money to try to fix this? I think it's a very rational thing to do to say, we think a COLA trigger that costs the fund money, but is still 25 years out, is not a good use of resources. And I think all of our members would agree. To his point as well, when we look at our early retirement factors, we have fewer and fewer people taking advantage of them, but everyone pays for it, et cetera. When we look at all of these savings and these reallocations, that's 3.3%. That's I think, a very substantial amount. And the funding is as well, and we appreciate that. From a funding perspective, the package last year called for an increase on the employer side of 2.5% phased in over 4 years, plus $5 million of direct funding. What that does is it not only tackles the contributions to get them where they need to be to fund this plan, to bring it to a sufficiency, but it takes that funded ratio and brings it into a sustainable level to make sure that this plan can actually withstand any shocks that are coming its way over the next few years. And while there are certainly conversations about maybe the employees shouldn't kick in because they've gone for so many years paying actually more, we felt it was important to contribute to there as well. We have our employees contributing 0.25% in the fifth year. And the reality is, as you look at the lifespan of the plan, we think it's probably going to be necessary in 5 years anyway. So when we look at the lines below, the 2017 omnibus pension bill would have St. Paul fully funded. It would accelerate the funded ratio. It represents good policy decisions on how to spend the internal pension dollars. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Schertz? I must be getting sick too, Ms. Schertz, because I think that chart on page 3 is really fun to look at. Just telling you.
I get it. So that's the risk of including charts like this. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Schertz. Thank you for your work.
Thank you
to all the directors and their members. You guys, you're very patient. You're very great to work with. Our conversation will be continuing. As I mentioned, members, before you leave, we're going to have probably three more meetings before the start of the session, the week of January 22nd to the 26th, the 29th through February 2nd, and February 5th through the 9th. So look for an email that will have some options in there. And like I said, I didn't explain it very well, but some of the ideas in these meetings will be to look at the public pension policy program from Kurt Winkleman, who is a senior fellowship at the University of Minnesota. We're also going to look at the conversion of pension plans to defined contribution plans from chief legal counsel from Montana, and also Joseph Fox from the Oklahoma. We're going to look at trends in public pension plan reform from Deloitte, reports on trends and forecasts for public employment in Minnesota from our state demographer, and we'll go back to MMB, Mr. Tan, for the deferred augmentation discussion. We're also going to look at stress testing, as I said, with Representative Vogel and some of the work there with Virginia. And our bills, our 2017 omnibus pension bill updated to 2018, what we're going to do there. And also other bills such as our para admin bill, bills that have been introduced by our legislators, and the LCPR staff statutes cleanup bill. And then we also have a housekeeping bill for the principles of pension policy and the standards for actuarial work. So we do have some work going forward, and I do appreciate your attendance. Is there any further questions, comments? Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You caught, I think, all of us off guard with a quick rundown on the dates. Could you just maybe bring those proposed date weeks that you're looking at again?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. And thank you. So it would be January 22nd through the 26th. January 29th through February 2nd, and February 5th through the 9th.
Thank you.
And I could get this suggested meeting itinerary out to you also to let you know that, what we're thinking of. But with questions, comments, Again, thank you very much. Happy New Year to everybody. Be safe. Be well. Meeting is adjourned. Okay, so could we get that out to him?